Have you missed me? I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk. Coming up, The Sun ditches New Labour. We discuss the impact of News International's step to the right. Does it matter in the digital media age? Also in the podcast...
It's a sad day. Officially, I have to admit to being, at best, and even this might be contested, the third most famous person from Mansfield.
Richard Bacon looks set to inherit Simon Mayo's slot on Five Live. Is that the best that station boss Adrian Van Claveren can do? And...
Have you ever seen a professor with a gun before?
Yeah, it's a pretty specialised field.
ITV's Primeval is saved from extinction by the BBC. How did that happen? All this and much more. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Well, in the week that Harriet Harman had another pop at Page Three, I'm delighted to report that both of my guests are fully informed and fully clothed. Steve Busfield is The Guardian's head of media and technology. Probably just as well.
I certainly have more clothes on than Harriet from Peckham on Page Three of The Sun this morning.
Yes, absolutely. Very good. Joining Steve in the pod is Maggie Brown, Media Guardian columnist. And I'm told that on your last appearance on a rival media programme, you were introduced as veteran media reporter.
I've got used to it. I'm used to ageism. I can handle it.
How dare they? Well, it's good to be back. Let's start this week, as Ben Elton used to say, with a bit of politics.
Gordon and I have been married for 9 years now. I know he's not a saint. He's messy. He's noisy. He gets up at a terrible hour. But I know that he wakes up every morning and goes to bed every evening thinking about the things that matter. I know he loves our country. And I know he will always, always put you first.
Well, we were all terribly moved, Sarah, but James Murdoch and the other bigwigs at News International clearly weren't. After 12 years of support, The Sun, on its front page the morning after Gordon Brown's conference speech, declared Labour's lost it. The paper will now be putting its full considerable weight behind David Cameron and the Conservatives in the run-up to the forthcoming election. So is it all over, bar the voting, for Brown and co? We'll hear from the panel and from Julian Glover, The Guardian's chief leader writer, in just a moment, but by coincidence, the legendary former Sunday Times editor, Harry Evans, was around at The Guardian this week promoting the latest volume of his autobiography, so I asked him for his thoughts.
I wouldn't get too excited about the fact that The Sun decided to drop Labour. I mean, it's political news, but it's not the end of the world for Labour.
But it's interesting about how the Labour Party itself reacted.
Well, the Labour Party did, because they felt that Mr Murdoch used personal relationships or whatever. I read the papers and all the criticism of it. But I think Mendelssohn was right that you have to keep it into perspective. Don't get too excited about it.
The Labour Party had sort of nailed its colours to the Murdoch mast, hadn't they?
In the past, when Tony Blair came in, I thought, and I said at the time, that they felt that he had an obligation to the Sun was a big mistake. He would have won that election, Tony Blair, without making any concessions to anybody. The whole populace, you know, there's only so far even a good newspaper can actually, in a very immediate situation, have an effect. The effect of a newspaper is much more cumulative and gradual.
Harry Evans there, he doesn't think it'll make much difference, but Julian Glover, our chief leader writer, disagrees.
It does matter if what The Sun does affects the kind of people who read The Sun, and one assumes it must have an impact with them. Because in the old days, when the Tories won in the 80s, the Thatcher years, they piled up majorities on people who didn't read The Sun. They got 60, 70% of AB voters. They got, or probably Guardian readers, secretly someone must have gone out and voted Tory. And Sun readers, even though their paper backed the Tories, mostly didn't vote for Maggie. There were a few who did on council houses and sales. But generally, they stuck with Labour. These days, there's a lot less difference between AB voters, DE voters. AB voters, quite sceptical about Cameron. There's a majority support the Tories, but not more than 50%. But the crucially, the Tories now lead in all social categories. So Labour's lost that core kind of rooted working-class vote it used to have, which would guarantee victory in at least a certain number of seats. And The Sun probably will influence those people. As it gets closer to polling day, Labour intends to tell people who use public services, people who need the money from the state, that Tories are going to cut, it's going to be horrible. Well, if The Sun's sort of reassuring them that Labour's just bonkers and the Tory party's the way forward, it's obviously not going to swing everybody, but it could have an effect of shoring up that vote. And without it, the Tories won't win.
Because the number of people, according to polls, a number of Sun readers who are defecting from Labour to the Tories is quite significant, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, one of the ironies is that how the readers vote is often not related to what the paper says. So in the 80s, quite a lot of Sun readers voted Labour, even though their paper told them not to. And now quite a lot have begun to shift to the Tories, even though editorially, at least, the Sun is still nominally back Labour. Now, that might be because really what they pick up is it's not the editorial column in the paper, which the Sun says, which I'm sure some people read, but maybe not too many, but the overall tone of the newspaper. And that's the crucial thing. Does the paper look like it thinks Labour's rubbish, or does it give them a fair go? And certainly ever since Gordon Brown became leader, the Sun's effectively been a Tory paper. It's been very sceptical of things like immigration, government policy, on almost everything. The only nominal bit of pro-Labourism has been the leader column. Now that's gone too. It'll reinforce it, perhaps not transform it.
And the other interesting aspect of it, and perhaps more interesting, is the fact of the timing, which suggests that it's a media story, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting because Labour has two messages. One is, this is irrelevant, it won't affect anything. And the other is, we're completely obsessed with it and going to talk about nothing else at the conference. I was in the News Corporation party when the kind of news was breaking. There weren't many Labour cabinet ministers. David Miliband was there looking a bit kind of miserable, but he obviously wants to keep friends with them. Alan Johnson was there too, so maybe two of the next potential leaders were both in the room, but I think that was chance. There was quite a lot of anxiety, I think, some amongst some Sun people there, certainly amongst Times people, just about the brazen timing. And then two theories. One is, if you're going to do it big and get some coverage, and that's worked. And I think, looking back, they won't regret this timing. And the other is, there was a bit of a feeling, well, you did it whatever Gordon Brown's speech was like. They'd obviously decided beforehand. They booked the poster vans that were driving around Brighton saying, you know, we're going blue.
They booked the chemicals to put blue smoke over Wapping.
Exactly. So, you know, it was all ready to go. Now, theoretically, I guess somebody could have rung up and said, hey, Gordon's speech is so good, we're not going to switch. But that wasn't real. So there was a bit of feeling they weren't really reporting or responding to events. They were just trying to trash them. But they've got their coverage, and that, I think, will cheer them up.
Julian Glover there. Maggie Brown, picking up on what Julian was saying, this was quite carefully orchestrated, wasn't it?
But,
where does this stand in the history of Sun leader lines?
Well, funnily enough, the Sun is 40 years old in November, and I think that this is a materially different type of switching. In the past, their leaders have tended to be very, very raucous and very, very personal and direct. But this change of sides was more meditated upon, quite clearly. I mean, when you actually look at the number of people, the key people at the Sun who all contributed their bit, and the pull-out poster, which was going through, as Julian has just said, a great many policies that they disagree with or they feel very upset about, from the badly equipped soldiers in Afghanistan to MRSA and dirty hospitals. I mean, there's a whole swathe, including, of course, as well, unrestrained, as they see it, immigration, that there are many, many issues with which they are quarrelling with Labour. And I think this is actually quite different in a way. So it's almost a more mature Sun that we're seeing here, a middle-aged Sun, a grumpy Sun, if you like. The other thing I would say is that I actually do not think that you can dismiss it as easily as some great ex-editors like Harry Evans are saying. I know that we're in a different era with new media, but you only have to look at the impact on the politicians. Gordon Brown looking as if he'd been stung by a load of wild bees early next morning, that it creates an atmosphere that they're doomed, they're going down. And I was speaking last night to somebody, rather, we were having a debate about whether the Standards attacks on Ken Livingstone had actually...
London, Evening Standard.
Yes,
yeah.
Evening Standard. I'm sorry to be a bit London-centric, but, you know.
But they definitely
turned against Ken and had a sustained attack on him and his administration and his works. And did that affect the outcome of the election? Debate, but I think it probably did.
The timing was clearly carefully orchestrated to make a big media splash, wasn't it? I don't think it'll make any electoral difference.
Well, the timing was incredibly cruel. I mean, you know, you couldn't get crueler than straight after Gordon Brown has his big moment to say, well, yeah, and absolutely, you know, we're not going to support you. The word from inside Wapping is that they really hadn't decided that they were going to do it until after they'd heard his speech. But they were clearly gearing up for
right.
it.
They bought the poster vans. They were
going to do it. They were definitely going to do it. It was just a particularly cruel time to do it. there was also, interestingly, it came the day after Ben Bradshaw had made his much less heralded speech, which was about 10 minutes long, but during which he seemed to side with the BBC rather than James Murdoch over the last few weeks.
I'm on the side of the BBC, he said, didn't he, against Sky. That must have really riled them.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think that thing that Maggie was saying about how Gordon Brown looks, you know, so crestfallen afterwards about it, I think it's possibly not because they know the effect it will have, but because they know that the Sun would only do it if they've already decided who the winner is. You know, not because they think that's the way the wind's blowing. That's because they have decided the Sun that the Tories are going to win. That's why they're backing them.
They want to be on the side of the winners.
They want to be on the side of the winners. That's how they do it. They don't do it actually, but you know, through belief in policies.
Because we've got the interesting example of the Scottish Sun that hasn't decided what to do and whether to back Cameron. Well, you know Scotland better than I do, but it's only got one Conservative MP.
That would be ridiculous for the Scottish Sun to back Cameron because Cameron's just an irrelevance in Scotland.
But it's a tenth of their sales, so yeah. they have to come up with some
exactly
policy.
And last time they backed the SNP.
What
they'll do in the general election, I don't know. But it'll be very interesting to see.
Maybe let's look on the positive side as well, you know, because now that the Sun has said this early, this long before an election has even been called, before we even know when it is, perhaps the Labour Party will stop feeling that they have to be beholden to the right-wing press. And, you know, maybe they'll start, you know, doing some policies that people on the left can believe in.
It's also interesting that it's done at a time when there's a transition in the editor, isn't there?
Dominic's in the editor.
But he's newly in the chair. It has to be said, quite an inexperienced editor. We hear, according to Peter Mandelson on Newsnight, that this was all orchestrated by Trevor Kavanagh and James Murdoch.
Who actually made the call is a good question, and I think the belief is that it was James that made the call.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was ever thus, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Murdoch's in charge of take decisions at the Sun, shock. You know, perhaps not. Well, there's more on this on our Politics Weekly podcast. And for the very best political coverage around, go to guardian.co.uk/politics. And in Media Guardian on Monday, look out too for an interview with Harry Evans.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Now, of course, I've been away for the past month, so it's good to see that ITV have finally sorted out their chief executive situation. Except they haven't, have they? Why is it taking them so? What happened? What was going on with Tony Ball?
Well, quite clearly, they got themselves. First of all, the really bad thing about it is that the shareholders became far too dominant and decided really that they wanted this man in, or a good section of them did. And they were pushing Tony Ball come hell or high water, and he became the last one really there. They had a leak of the preferred candidate. And the board were faced with this really unpalatable decision, as they saw it, of appointing Wrecking Ball, who wanted £42 million.
£42 million. This is outrageous. I know you talked about it last week, but I've spent most of last week
lighthouse
on the west coast of Scotland. So I have to say, I'm new to this story. But
I'm very upset by the whole thing. I'm upset because. ITV is a cultural institution. It isn't just a business. It isn't just a stock exchange toy. And to have shareholders taking, in my opinion, quite a wrecking view about ITV, it sounds to me as if we don't actually know what Tony Ball was planning to do with ITV. We do know that Michael Grabe was unable to raise a rights issue back in the spring, and this led to this whole sequence of events, him having to step back from running the company. And of course, there's this whole, you know, recriminations breaking out over whether you should have combined chairman and chief executive. Never again, say the city, because one can't obviously then appoint another. But when you stand back, what we have here is still a great channel. If you look at the number of big audiences it goes on attracting, ITV really matters. And without it, the BBC and BBC One in particular don't have a competitive scale.
Doesn't all of this demonstrate what you've written about on the Media Guardian website this week? This week, that there is really a dearth of leadership. But Channel 4's lacking a leader, and there's no obvious candidate. And as you were pointing out, there's no succession plan for Mark Thompson at the BBC. Where are all these good people? There must be people there.
I think it's absolutely scandalous. With ITV, it's been mismanaged over decades. And this is where I have some sympathy with Michael Grade. I think when you look back, you'll find that he has not been such a terrible chief executive, because the conditions, if you have a third of your income just falling away in advertising, and you have a company that has been only sketchily reorganized into one from regional disparate units, it is a really, really difficult thing to get right. As for the leadership issues with the BBC, there used to be proper training schemes. I mean, the much maligned John Burt used to send likely people, including Thompson, but many others, to business school, and they were moved around jobs. And what strikes me, and having watched the top of the BBC over the past month or so, one's just appalled, quite frankly. I'm just appalled. I am appalled by people who can't string consecutive sentences together, who have to have PRs who then translate what they meant to say.
Yes.
A deputy who's on holiday when the director general's on holiday. Do I have to say any more? It just goes on and on.
Yeah.
Do we not think Mark Byford is going to be the next director general of the BBC?
Mark Byford's a very nice man, but he at least can talk in sentences, Maggie.
Yes, but do you remember?
But they're not very interesting. They're just not very interesting ones.
After Greg Dyke left, do you remember? We won't reprise the cruel moments that then occurred.
I was talking to Mark about cricket, though.
Mark Thompson about cricket?
No, Mark Byford.
Mark Byford.
Yorkshire.
He knows his cricket. Good, excellent. Let's move on to some other media news in briefs. We were talking about that earlier. Richard Bacon is to get Simon Mayer's afternoon slot on Five Live. Apparently Mark Radcliffe turned it down, we hear. What do we think about this, Steve?
Well, I mean... It's interesting that the BBC just seems to be shuffling around the sort of people it's got without any idea that, you know, that there's some talent outside elsewhere. And I think that's quite possibly because there isn't any talent elsewhere. You know, the commercial radio sector is in enormous difficulties and isn't bringing through a new generation. I think it's also possibly indicative of the fact that the BBC now has so much radio output that actually, you know, you see some radio presenters appearing on more than one station. You know, you'll see them on sort of Six Music and Two or Six Music and One.
Well, interestingly, Simon Mayer is going to stay on Five Live on the Friday show with the film critic Mark Kermode, isn't he? So the new presenter, it's going to be Richard Bacon, only gets Monday to Thursday. Isn't that rather like a football manager becoming a director of football, you know, it's pretty bad for the new guy, isn't it?
Well, if he gets 4 days a week, day a week. I think there's also a question about the radio business itself. That, you know, is it sort of, you know, I mean, we all know that it's got an awful lot of commercial difficulties. Is it sort of dying off in people's desire to work in it, that, you know, that the next generation aren't coming through to it? I mean, you look at the number of people who are now working in radio who used to work in television, and that is seen as a perfectly acceptable career move.
Is it because of the lack of a desire to take risks on the part of the radio controllers, so they appoint people, Maggie, who they know and they've heard of, who the audience has heard of?
I think that is true. I think that there's a sort of internal, as you say, movement without any new blood coming in, and that can't be right. On the other hand, you have to remember there's a sort of amplification factor at the BBC. Any mistake it makes on air just goes on and becomes a major issue. So you can see why they play safe, because it's safer to have safe people or safe pairs of hands who've been through all of their editorial training processes.
Richard Bacon, safe pair of hands.
Well, safer. I mean,
in the same sentence.
But let's. He's had to come through the fire, hasn't he?
He has come through the fire.
He resuscitated his career after, you know, going away and learning some hard lessons. Isn't one of the other noticeable things that they're nearly all male DJs that we're talking about? That there are very, very few women involved in all of these change rounds. I think, you know, is Sarah Kennedy about the only major sort of female broadcaster on Radio 2 now?
There's no female daytime, even peak time presenter on Radio 2. And Five Live does a bit better, doesn't it, with Victoria Derbyshire in the morning.
They have lots of giggling girls around, don't they? I mean, that's sort of how they even it up, certainly on Radio 1. Drives me potty.
All right. Listen, Maggie, there's been... I'm glad you're fired up this week. There's another row in BBC drama, isn't there? Andrew Davis has sparked it off this time, the veteran dramatist and adapter. He's been sounding off in the Radio Times, I think.
That's right. I mean, he's saying that it's all very well doing period drama, but now the BBC aren't doing enough of it, and they're not doing the right ones, i.e. books like The Palliser's, which he adapts.
Yes.
I mean, it's all part of this...
Has he got a point, or is it just sour grapes at his stuff?
I regard it as sour grapes. I mean, one of his points was that, the BBC isn't doing Dombey and Son, the Charles Dickens novel. It's going to do David Copperfield again. But why not do David Copperfield again? Because there's always a rising generation, and it's a fantastic and very moving story.
We were talking about merry-go-rounds in the BBC. The other appointment that's happened this week is that BBC Children's has got a new man in charge, Joe Godwin. You're our children's expert, Maggie. Is that a good point?
Yes, I'm pretty relaxed about it. On the grounds that, look, we've got somebody who knows about children's television. Richard Deverell was really a technology executive who's going on to, who the previous controller, going on to mastermind the move to Manchester, or Salford, sorry, I must say. So, and best of all, you get the really good CBeebies controller, Michael Carrington, staying put. I mean, he's absolute gold dust.
Excellent. We'll leave that there. For links to all of these stories, head to our page on Media Guardian, which is at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. The Telegraph's long-running Alex cartoon strip documenting the life of a yuppie investment banker has become the first British newspaper character to find a home on the iPhone. Alex's misadventures through the credit crunch are now available as an interactive daily tapisode, apparently, that's what they call them, on Apple's smartphone. Jörg Tittel is the producer and designer behind the app. He thinks it's just the start of bringing newspaper art and graphics into the 21st century.
The Alex app is, as far as I know, the first proper interactive motion comic on a mobile platform. And what that means, it's an animated comic book, and you actually tap your way through it from frame to frame, basically, except that all these frames are fully animated. Comic books, the way they've been currently translated to either mobile platforms or video game systems or your PC or Mac, have been rather uninspired. It's either been scanned in pages of existing comic books that you sort of slide from slide to slide through, basically a glorified slideshow, or they've done motion comics, which are animated films which are linear, i.e. you have to watch them all the way through, and they aren't as good in quality as animated films by Pixar, let's say. So we wanted to find a new way of expressing comic books on mobiles, and I think we found the right solution to it. We're already on the 21st spot in the entertainment charts on the iPhone in the App Store. So I think we're doing rather well. And I mean, especially after this media talk, I know we're going to explode and go straight to the number one spot.
It's a very influential podcast like that. So imagine literally tens of people are listening to this interview now. Where does this product go from here? Where does interactivity with newspapers and new, where does that go in 10 years from here?
I'm very excited about how newspapers and media companies worldwide are trying to reinvent themselves. And I think this is a great time. And I think the economic challenges that we're all facing are making us more creative than we've ever been. And the iPhone, for instance, is a great little device because everything, is just so perfectly integrated in it. The store, all the different features, the camera, and soon, the idea of bringing things like augmented reality to newspapers excites me very much. And it's something I want to do in the future as well, where you literally will see your news pop out of the page onto your telephone screen. Personally, I'm interested in making news three-dimensional eventually, and actually using real 3D graphics and pretty simple 3D engines at first, and we can get more and more complex from there. For instance, when you see a certain accident or a plane crash recreated on television, you usually see rather rudimentary 3D graphics to doing that. And you could do that with newspapers in the future. And basically, you just move your phone over the article. There's a little marker, like a little barcode, essentially, on the page. And that will then bring up that whatever the article is referring to in 3D. It can also be videos that it can load from the internet, whatever you want. And I think that's where we're going, where we're basically connecting the real world with the virtual more and more. So they become one, essentially.
Jörg Tittel there speaking to producer Ben. What do we think about Alex?
We love Alex, and it was a great tragedy for the Independent when the Telegraph pinched it quite some time ago, because it was a defining cartoon, and you know it became slightly less. It felt like it became slightly less irreverent when it moved to the Telegraph. I also think, you know, it's fantastic for readers and iPhone users to get more stuff from the cartoonists, because quite often what they don't realise is the amount of genius work that the cartoonists do behind. When I was on the back bench of the newspaper, and David Austin was still alive, God bless him, and he used to do the front page cartoon. He used to sit in conference listening to all these very dry stories that were going to go on the front page of The Guardian. And then he would come back a couple of hours later with 9 different cartoons that were all hilarious and fantastic.
Only one of them.
And only one of them, you know, saw the light of day. And actually, you know, if they have some, you know, some place where they can put out more of their work, then, you know, then I think people will realise just the genius that goes into it.
Okay, thank you, Steve. The Alex application is available for a mere 59 pence at the iTunes App Store. More details on our blog. And in the interest of balance, you'll be thrilled to know that the Guardian's iPhone app is on its way.
Your job's to tighten up security in every area of the Ark. As you may know, we've had a number of unfortunate lapses recently.
I'm aware of that.
You're also aware of the work we do here? You detect anomalies and fight dinosaurs.
When necessary.
Correct. You don't sound surprised.
I have extensive experience in dinosaur handling, sir. I assume that was why I was picked for the job.
I take it that's some sort of joke?
Yes, sir.
A lot of people are sceptical when they first join us, Becca. They don't stay that way for long.
Goodness, that's exciting. We'll finish up this week by talking television. Eagle-eyed viewers will have seen that ITV's dinosaur romp Primeval has been saved from extinction this week with a bit of help from BBC Worldwide. Tim Hames is the creative director of Impossible Pictures, the production company behind Primeval.
We had a lot of people writing in and online campaigns to bring it back when it was announced last summer it was cancelled. And I think, although some shows like Primeval are inconsequential, happy entertainment, that's actually why some people watch television.
It's an interesting deal that you've done. BBC Worldwide have put up quite a lot of the money. Is it a bit odd that the BBC should come to the rescue of an ITV show?
Well, it's not. You've got to look at the BBC as being more than the BBC that everyone's familiar with. BBC Worldwide is not the BBC you know and love. It is a commercial organisation that's trying to sell things around the world, and we do a lot of work with them and have done for years on ITV projects and other projects.
Is ITV really committed to this, do you think? Because when they cancelled it the first time round, they said that they were going to concentrate on post-watershed drama. Is their heart in it?
I think they would love to have pre-watershed drama. They had to make some very hard decisions at ITV, and they can't just sort of pick and choose. I think they had to make some policy or strategic decisions, one of which was to cancel pre-watershed drama. Peter Fincham, who was the man who reinvented Saturday Night by commissioning both Merlin and Doctor Who. So
when he was controller of BBC One.
When he was controller of BBC One, sorry. And he loves it in his heart. But they've been through a torrid time, and that was just one of the things he gave up.
It was cost, wasn't it, really? It came down to.
Yes. I mean, their return on investment calculations have become God, so they need to attend to that. And they will try and do projects and spend a little bit more on projects they think will have an effect. But in this particular case, the cost of a drama can be so outside other stuff they play at pre-watershed that I think they decided they couldn't stand that. Mm.
What about the state of this kind of drama in Britain at the moment? The audience is more demanding, aren't they? They want the special effects. They're used to Doctor Who. They're used to Merlin. They're used to Primeval. These are all very expensive to produce, though, aren't they?
Yes, I think that's only fair. No one has to sort of apologise for watching a television programme. And actually, well, ever since I did Walking with Dinosaurs, the technology that Hollywood developed for making very convincing digital imagery has become democratised. And there, every place, whether you're in New Zealand, Australia or London or Paris, they can do this. But it still isn't cheap. But people have seen the cinema version. Why should they see something that's a bit embarrassing and wobbly on television? As I say, the only way, though, that broadcasters can afford it is if a large part of the budget is being paid by someone else as well.
Tim Hames there. I mean, this is interesting what Tim was saying. Co-productions seem to be the way ahead, and it was the independent production company that put together the deal, the broadcaster.
Exactly. I think this is fantastic. And it's a pointer to one future anyway for TV drama, which in this case, they're having to use computer-generated imagery, obviously, for the monsters, the prehistoric monsters. So this was not a case where you could just cut the budget and hope to get by with fewer actors. You had to, it requires a scale of production, this. Fascinating that it's BBC Worldwide who have come in to rescue this because they screen it on BBC America and it's sold very widely.
Well, very interestingly, Tim was saying, not in that clip, but just as he was leaving The Guardian, actually, that it sells abroad really well, better, for example, than Doctor Who.
Well, because it's kind of universal. It's got this very glamorous, good-looking set of scientists, stroke whatever they are, and Ben Miller, of course. And then it has these incredible monsters. So it has you on the edge of the seat. It's a great romp. And I think it's actually...
What's
not to like. But don't you think it is interesting? BBC Worldwide has been under tremendous attack for investing in the wrong sort of things. It has, though, also invested in some very good startup independents like Left Bank Pictures, Andy Harris's company that's making Wallander. Wallander, again, is a co-production, high-profile but BBC programme, which sells way beyond UK. So we're beginning to see certain good, interesting brands coming, getting different streams of revenue from different places and not just dependent on one broadcast, in this case, cash-strapped ITV. I think it's a fantastic outcome. Mm.
Sorry, I'm stunned by two things that Maggie said there. One, that the dinosaurs aren't real. And no, two, it's got a cast full of good-looking people and Ben Miller.
You did say that. That's me. I was very mean.
He's my favourite actor. But I don't know where you put him in all of that.
Yeah. In other TV news. Very excitingly, there's a big new sci-fi series started this week, so it should be right up your street, Steve, isn't it?
I'm very excited about it.
Flash forward, but
we PVR'd it, and we're going to be watching it at the weekend. Well, so no spoilers, please.
No, I'm not going to spoil it. Well, the interesting thing about it, another thing that Tim Hames was saying actually, as I bundled him out of the door, was that Flash Forward, Maggie, is interesting because it's actually police procedural, basically. They're investigating a thing that happens to be slightly sci-fi in that everyone in the world fell asleep for two minutes and saw the future. But in effect, it's in all other senses, it's a police procedural. And America does that very well. They take in order that the audience is comfortable with the format, they take something that is very familiar, that's in a familiar setting, and just add a little twist.
And these two worlds collide. I mean, it's the same as Lost or a lot of other programmes. I think it's got great potential. What interests me too about this is that it's Five again who've spotted this. And I did a little bit of talking around here. And Five have brought back the original person who used to buy their acquisitions, Jeff Ford. And this is one of his first strikes. And it's very interesting.
Because they used to be big on like CSI. They spotted all those ones that were coming
Jeff,
up, didn't they?
Jeff Ford is definitely
He's moved back from Channel 4 to 5. And it just shows how you don't need millions of talented people. You need the right talented person in the right place.
Definitely a very good acquisition for them. I mean, it got 3.2 million or something on Tuesday, brilliant. which is good figures for Five.
Will we be doing episode by episode live blog? I see we're putting out a book of these. This is The Wire. Are you editing this?
I am editing this, yes. Well, it's a new way of, creating content. And you know,
revenue, presumably.
Well, I'm not sure how many Wire... given the viewing figures for The Wire, how many people are going to...
probably all of them. No, seeing how dedicated they are to the show. Now, listen. Has anyone been watching MasterChef: The Professionals? Have you been watching this, Maggie?
No, not really. Well, I've been watching the Paula Grady show. If you really want to.
No. There is a reason why I was asking.
While it's still there.
Well, yes. There is a reason why
I was asking you this because. This is all just by way of a gratuitous introduction to a clip that producer Ben has put together. And I have to say this. I wonder what Greg Wallace was eating here.
Beautiful, sticky sauce. The creamy flavour of your custard is lovely. Creamy, slippery and salty flavour. Presentation is good. I think your custard is fantastic.
Yes, there really hasn't been enough rudeness on this podcast since Gareth McLean left. We do miss you, Gareth. Thanks to Maggie Brown. Thank you for being so. Thank you for being so animated. There we are. Time to go. Is it? Thanks to Steve Busfield. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening.